Chris, thanks for that generous introduction, and thank you also for coming today. I talked to David some time ago about the fact that I was starting to see a number of key issues emerge out of the global financial crisis, which I think will have very significant medium to long-term impacts on all of us. And when I came back to Australia, it's almost like people thought the global financial crisis wasn't happening. But on the global board, I'm seeing more and more issues than when I talked to directors. So what I'm going to do today was, in my time, run through very quickly a snapshot or menu of issues that I actually think are consequences that we'll all need to address over the next few years. And I call this the bucket list because it seems to me, if you've actually seen the recent movie, The Bucket List, it's about a near-death experience of a person actually wanting to get things off their chest in a relatively short period of time. And when you look at the state of our global financial system, I think the Western capital markets have a near-death experience. And I think we're very lucky that we've revived and resuscitated. And so I actually want to look at key stakeholders today, go through my list of things that I think have flown to the crisis and suggest, somewhat provocatively, some issues that I think that you might see emerge in the next few years. Now, if you're like me, you think very hard about what caused the global financial crisis. And there's all sorts of theories, but I think I've actually found the culprit. And to me, I blame Sex and the City. Because it seems to me, these are our role models in the past 10 years. This is a top-rating TV program, and it's about four young independent women creating a new lifestyle in Manhattan, New York. And the central character, Carrie Bradshaw, wakes up one day and says, I own $40,000 worth of shoes, banana blinds to be precise, and I can't afford to deposit on a house. My credit cards are way over their limit. What am I going to do? Well, being a very lateral thinker, Carrie Bradshaw is introduced to Mr. Big, an investment banker who has a reputation who turned a $3 million building into $100 million worth of cash. And that's exactly what happened. These people went out, found buildings, revamped them, borrowed against them, leveraged and sold that security several times through the media until they finally became bank assets. And of course, the collapse occurred, and so what are the consequences that actually flow from that? I think we're all living through those. Now, so turning to individuals first, and Carrie Bradshaw of this world, it seems to me you've got to think about these people in two different categories, those in the West and those in the East. Those in the West are going to behave very rationally. They're now going to pay back their credit cards. Even Carrie Bradshaw in the movie cut up her credit card and started taking the bus. What it means is you're going to see a significant consumer strike start to occur in the United States, a massive deleveraging as those consumers start to behave responsibly and actually correct their existing over-leverage. And we actually want them to do that. We actually want them to basically save money, repay their debt, and actually stabilise the Western financial system. If you contrast that to what's happening in the East, we have a different problem. We have the people in China, basically, who have no social security system, no prospect of pension, no healthcare, who have to save every dollar they earn. So they don't spend. They put their money in a bank under the mattress, so to speak, and aren't very good at consuming and spending. And this is going to be the major economic dislocation we have for a period of time. And interesting, I was in China 2 weeks ago and had presentations from both Bank of China and CIC. And both of them said, look, in the short term, don't worry about us. Our fiscal stimulus package is working in the provinces. We're spending the right amount of money. But we're very worried about what could happen in 2 or 3 years' time. We think we're going to have substantial overcapacity in our industry. And the problem is going to move from consuming nations to producing nations. So how do we, in that period, a short period of time, adjust our economy? And how can we actually stimulate our consumers to underwrite and increase their share of GDP and private consumption in our economy to stabilise our economy? So they said there's two things we have to do. We're not just about buying resources. We've got to buy technology. We've got to buy brands. We have to get up the value supply chain very quickly. And we're going to look at countries which are synergistic to Australia, where those technologies and brands are important to us. And Australia was on their list of five countries. And so I don't think you see anything like the way of Chinese investment that you're going to see in the next 3 to 4 years. I think also there's going to be significant social consequences. The Carrie Bradshaws of this world are going to find themselves in severe financial distress. They're going to be more distressed when they have to look at their tax responsibilities over the years to come, funding the next generation of Generation Zs or Ys coming through, and they're going to be demanding much more accountability from government and institutions, organisations that got themselves into this situation. You're already seeing that now with the debate on executive pay and remuneration. But we see it more problematically in Eastern Europe, for example, where we start seeing massive social distress, political unrest, which could well have the potential to have very significant ramifications in terms of global foreign policy, for example. I also think that the superannuation industry, I doubt to don't see the Carrie Bradshaw of this world or Mr. Biggs follow the traditional investment patterns. I think they're going to be very suspicious of equity markets, alternative hybrids, timber plantations, and all the traditional investments that people have. And I think you'll see a real refocus in retail investors for what they require. And I think a success factor will be what are the products that you will create that will give them the certainty that they need to fund their retirement. And I'll come back to that. The second issue is related to banks. Lehman Brothers collapsed on the 15th of September 2008, and the ramifications, I think, are well known to you all in terms of the knock-on consequences, the freezing of the debt markets, and the interbank markets. What then are we going to do about this? And I have to say, I was a little intimidated when President Obama was going to announce today his changes in this area, and I've not been through them, but at a high level, I don't think they're far away from what I'm going to suggest. The first thing that people don't understand is banks are very fragile creatures. Banks run a very high leverage model. Their capital base can be 8 to 10% of 8 to 10%. It doesn't require a substantial change in asset values or credit losses to actually put pressure on bank balance sheets. Our banks have basically funded themselves by going into US debt markets and accessing cheap credit, can be able to US housing market to basically lend money here on key infrastructure projects, getting very good credit spreads. Now, as you know, those markets might be closed, we have a government guarantee, but the flow of funds is nowhere today like it was 2 years ago. So the first thing I think you have to do is find new sources of funds. And I suggest to you that you're going to see very substantial capitalisation of banks start to emerge from Asia, from Singapore, from Taiwan, from China. I think you're going to see a different type of capital flow and product created to have those investors put the capital providers into our banks down here. Secondly, I think you're going to see constraints put on banks in terms of how they can grow their balance sheet. Because I think what actually happens in the part of the cycle, if your credit growth gets ahead of your capital base, inevitably you're going to exacerbate the leverage problem and you're not going to actually follow the appropriate prudential management of your capital allocation. So in that sense, I think you'll see almost an anti-boom provision or legacy created by governments either requiring funds to be on deposit, requiring additional provisioning to be created in the boom part of the growth part of the cycle to ensure that we actually control or restrict the ability of banks to grow their balance sheets. The third thing I think you'll see is capital will have to be flexible. I think one of the problems we have here is people basically, whether it be Basel II or prudential requirements, said, here is your capital ratio as a bank. Now, banks are very different creatures these days to originally formed. They have funds management arms, stock rating arms, security houses, investment houses. And I think what you were starting to see was money channeled in terms of existing bank capital, which was actually 5 and 30 for a bank, into businesses and industries where there were different capital and debt ratios that actually were required. And the best example I think is the US housing boom. Under Basel II, you can actually allocate the lowest amount of capital to mortgages. So what would you do? You would basically try and maximise the growth in your mortgage potential. But of course, those funds that you raise from your mortgage capital wouldn't stay in that zone. They'd be passed across into leveraging other types of products, supporting investment arm, basically going out to look at infrastructure projects. So in other words, I don't think the single capital model for a bank actually will work in the future. And what I think you'll see is people start to regulate leverage and say, there are different businesses and I'll allow safe harbors or prudential ratios which are entirely different depending upon the business that you actually have. I also think the whole issue about integrated banks and banks being multi-financial houses, I think, is a model that's shown to be very forward in the United States. They clearly don't have the right governance, the risk management framework, or even the right culture, I think, to actually run a bank or a financial institution. So in that sense, I think you're going to see great pressure to disaggregate these models back to traditional banking. And I think the market will demand that, because I actually think the premiums paid for traditional banking service and access to finance will be quite robust and quite strong, give a good return of capital in the first few years. And saying that, I should say, I think APRA over time has done an excellent job, and I think the model that's created in Australia about having one prudential regulator is a model that needs to be institutionalised in other countries around the world. Now, whether it's if some of those could work, or HIH, woke us up. We were very lucky, I think, that our regulators were actually on top of the issues well and truly in advance. That clearly did not happen in the United States. The next issue I want to touch upon, on banks and more generally, is I have a view that risk management these days is becoming compliant. People have got long lists of issues, but people actually don't sit down and work out what is truly risk, what is the risk appetite, what do you expect to do as an organisation, and then mitigate and manage that risk. The best example I quote is people who engage in securities lending. How many trustees of super funds really understood that they actually lose legal title to those to their securities in return for a relatively small fee? And how many trustees have actually adjusted their exposure in securities lending following up the problem and all the issues that created around priorities? A very good case where people haven't thought about operational risk. But I think there are two other risks that people haven't focused on. One is catastrophic risk. Everyone has a standard deviation curve. If it's 95% probable, you try and manage it. No one worries about the 5% out here. That's the 5% to put you out of business. Who would have thought the banking system would close down? My supplier would go bankrupt, but I'd lose my license. Those are the issues that people don't focus on, catastrophic risks. The other one is multiple risks. I saw what happened in the last 12 months is risk hit you from everywhere. It didn't matter if it was swine flu, collapse of the banking system, suppliers under stress, currency moving by 30% in basically 6 weeks. These are issues that some professionals will get the whole time. How many of you have your management team stress test themselves in a hypothetical environment where all of those things are happening? People don't. They look at risk on a static basis. Where if you train an airline pilot, for example, they turn the engine off, they put a fire out in the wing, they give you a crisis around the back of someone's ship, and that's exactly the way people train to deal with multiple risks. We don't train our CEOs or our management team that way. As Chris also mentioned, I think the third thing in terms of banks was unregulated entities. The very fact that hedge funds accumulate the sort of capital that Chris talked about without any prudential supervision, regulation or reporting to me is absolutely flawed. A good example, subprime. Subprime came into the US official statistics for the first time in 2005, even though this had actually been happening since 1999. So for 6 years, no one's measuring this, yet it's the greatest single financial impact. So we need to make sure that all of the sector is at least subject to some transparency and scrutiny. I was going to make some comments on rating agencies, but I won't in the matter of time other than to say, I don't know what happened. I think there's a lack of due diligence, a lack of independence, and probably a lack of technical competency in many ways. And I think there's a real requirement to go back and think about that particular model, and I would argue that if you outsource a lot of those skills to organisations capable of doing this thing independently and properly. Sorry, I'll be controversial. In terms of the regulators, I think there's a huge issue looming in the world, and this is the one that worries me more than anything else, because we all talk about G20 as being the solution to our problems, and in many ways it should be, but it requires cooperation. And what I'm seeing globally within KPMG is the Obama administration more aggressively go back to enforcement, really entrench the sort of problems that are already in the US regulatory system around materiality, not being good for the trees, not actually looking at principles, going to process, getting to checklists, happening more and more. And I'm seeing the tremendous resistance from China, from Europeans, now saying, don't come into our territory. Your system has failed, our system is better, don't tell us how we should actually be regulating our energy. So there's this massive fight starting to take place between the participants of G20 about what the solution is. So your concept of having a global harmonised regulatory system, I think, is under some challenge. And the result of which, I think what we have to get to is strong national systems and greater cooperation between regulators on key issues of principle. So I think it's strong national regulation with probably a veneer of global overlay that's more likely to be achieved. Because I think if you go down the route and you're going to go for solutions, we'll still be arguing about this in 5 years' time. In particular, I think the Basel II regulations need to be reformed. I think they failed, but they caused a lot of problems around banks. And I don't think regulators understood that accounting standards actually do not give you a registered result. So you've got to get back to the basics of what really drives banks. And just on that, I'd like to put the whole issue of financial reporting on the table. How many of you invest in a company because the accountants give you a treat? through the fair use of the profit and loss, and all the costs applied with the capital accounting standards. How do we actually do that? Receive an annual report. Do we actually report the right things? When you make investment in a company, what are the KPIs that you actually look at when you actually sit down and decide what to invest in? I generally look and say, has there been a merger? Will they achieve those synergies? What is their cost to income ratio? What is their safety record? What are they doing around their environmental responsibilities about the carbon reduction? What is the quality of the management team, so to speak? None of those issues are basically surfaced or highlighted in annual financial data. None of them are subject to independent audit or attestation. So I think you need to work backwards and say, what do capital markets require, and why don't we actually deliver that going forward so there is transparency and we don't rely on this class of people called analysts, who frankly I think have been disappointed in the whole process and are recipients of information from companies. It's interesting, when I was working on the BHP Rio takeover last year, under the UK rules, you have to actually have your synergies attested, audited, and the market requires it almost to be a 90% probability that they'll be achieved in the prospectus documents you put out to raise capital. Why aren't those rules enshrined around the world? I'd also say to you that one thing that's also shown up is the flaws in internal management reporting that actually exist in organisations. And the best example I give is cash flow. I don't think anyone does cash flow statements anymore. They're fund statements. There's all sorts of peripheral adjustments. It's also done as the last single thing. But the reality is, no one has ever invented a new way to go broke. You run out of cash. Cash is the most important thing. So why boards and management are not getting forecasts in terms of cash flows and how they actually parallel with the banking rollover requirement coming forward, to me, is a bit of a scandal in organisations. So we need to go back and really rethink that. And finally, on accounting standards, a lot of criticism around accounting standards and the mark-to-market basis. In my view, the mark-to-market was a canary in the coal mine. It actually showed up the fragility of these assets and actually caused people to actually have to focus and write them down and actually surface the problem largely before it did. The problem is, mark-to-market assumes it's a market. The reality is there's no market. You obviously go from being valued at $100 to zero, and therefore that's pretty dramatic. And I think what has to happen with accounting standards is you need to say, they're actually cash flows. What are the cash flows that that instrument will actually create at a time, and then build in the degree of credit risk or coupon risk that's actually there? And I think you'll get to a much better result if there's some standard modelling that's actually revised. Finally, I'll say to you that I think this has been a great setback to a single global accounting standard. I think the possibility now of the US adopting IFRS and standardised accounting in the world will be dead for 5 years. And it's because they don't trust the Europeans. The Europeans have introduced legislation to override the accounting standards to protect their banks. And all that does is make the problem more endemic. No one trusts the numbers now coming out of the European banks as to where they're taking their medicine. And this, I think, is going to be a huge problem in terms of actually causing the financial crisis to be addressed. Moving on to companies. And I'm sure I don't need to tell any directors in the room about how the risk environment has changed fundamentally in terms of their responsibilities. And I think James Hardy is very slow to read to any director about their responsibilities and how far you go down the prison draft press release. It seems to me, if you actually strip the global financial crisis away, there are four causes of corporate failure. First, clearly there is the banks who basically invested in toxic assets. I think they're a class on their own. I think the issues that I've talked about really deal with that. Secondly, there are three major frauds. How could a Madoff, a Sakian, or a Swanton occur in a global financial market? It's the real indictment. And we need to sit down now. The reality is, when you actually look at these things, there was no due diligence. There was no decent audit of these organisations. There was no prudential supervision of these organisations. The head offices were based in very strange places. Now, the whole model, anyone could sit back, I would have said, as a reasonable person, in more normal times, said these models can't possibly work. The third thing is over-leverage. That always happens in the cycle. Basically, people over-borrow, they invest in illegal assets, they have to sell those assets at the wrong part of the cycle, and they therefore don't repay their debt. And finally, there is where the business models are flawed, and there's nothing you do to really legislate that. For me, it's about getting back to basics. You're basically looking at balance sheet management, which no company has been doing. Basically, everyone looks at revaluing assets and value at risk and economic return models going forward. And if people forget about the basics of gearing, cash flow, proper risk management. And I argue that if you do all those things, you actually highlight most of these particular problems. And it's really up to me as to whether we've learned the lesson, but I'll tell you what I think is actually going to happen is all these discounted rights issues, all these directors running up the market to its market, raising capital at value over 48 hours, doing no due diligence, therefore there is no defence for the corporation for. So if the material misstatement of facts or a subsequent event doesn't occur, I think there's huge problems, and I can't see directors then saying, oh, well, I was basically based on the James Harvey decision, I acted responsibly in that period of time. So I think there's an issue that people need to look at. Can I just get one of my subjects off the list, which is class actions? And I'm not about to argue against class actions. All I want to say is, I think the very plaintiff legal firms who go to directors and companies who require greater disclosure, transparency and code of conduct should look at themselves. Because I think these days I'm seeing a lot of behaviour in markets, in advertising potential claims to solicit class has been quite misleading in terms of the capacity of that claim to proceed, the inability to actually engage with those organisations to properly understand the risk, and all they're doing, it's really kind of noticing in Century Properties. We're sitting down, negotiating with the bank, trying to get a workout situation, and we read the front page, the headlines, two players legal firms arguing which one should run the class action against the bank. That's not very conducive to actually refloating, recapitalising that company. That's the sort of thing that I'm talking about. Moving to government, I won't spend a lot of time on this, but the real question to me is, are taxpayers getting a cheap entry into overseas assets by effectively acquiring all these major banks and brands, or are we going to be burdened with debt in the long term, and what are the consequences of the global bond market, and how would we deal with it? And the real risk to me is that a lot of these governments will say, there's an easy way out, the answer is not taxation, it's inflation. And when you've got fiscal stimulus packages coming through, and major inflation, it might actually suit some of these governments to actually start that inflationary cycle, which I still will, I think, ultimately dislocate economies such as ours. I also think there's a whole issue around sovereign debt and the importance, particularly in Eastern Europe, I think, of making sure those sovereign debts actually remain solvent at the moment is a major issue for the IMF. And I won't, for some of them, I'll come back and ask the question on foreign capital. Knowing I've been super funds today, I thought I'd make some comments on super funds. This is a graph of the equity market over the past, I think, 100 years or so. What it shows is this is the most volatile market in the world. Yet this is a thing which has been a key asset allocation for super funds and pension funds. And what are super funds and pension funds trying to do? You are trying to provide a lifestyle for an individual in their retirement, some certainty of their capacity to pay. Why then would you have such focus in terms of equity markets where you have this degree of volatility and risk? And you look at it, when the Costello reforms came through on super regulation, people plowed into equity, plowed into DIY funds, and if you look at the value now held in the DIY funds, I think the statistic is something like they've doubled in number and the net assets have gone down by a third. That indicates just how successful they've been in terms of actually taking up that initiative. Now, it seems to me that the government here has a real problem, because what it's effectively doing is underwriting the long-term retirement savings of individuals. It provides a pension. So you double this. You get your tax-free ability to try and make money in your super fund, knowing the government's always there to provide your pension if it falls over. So I think governments are going to start back and saying, we can't afford this cost, particularly with our demographic profile in Australia, so I'm going to require you to start to change your asset allocation basis. And I can see governments saying, I've got to fund this massive deficit, I need a mature bond market, this is exactly the source of funds that I'll be looking at. And I can see an introduction of the 30-20 rule, and I can actually see governments actually requiring funds, particularly DIY funds, to hold a certain amount of securities in bonds or securities. I also think products like annuities. Well, if the person creates the right annuity product, for me, is one that's actually going to be a winner going forward. And I think you're going to see some of these old products come back into fashion because they actually match the asset allocation to the liability they're trying to focus on. I'm also saying there's significant issues for trustees and super funds. Let me ask you one question. Why is always a balanced portfolio the default option in a super fund? And how much does that cost a number of those investors in recent years? And I wonder how many people are actually asking those questions or properly informing their investors around these issues. I wonder how they're going in terms of their liquidity model. And yes, there was a currency shock last year, of course people think about it, but I think it's not unlikely that you'll see a run in the fund, particularly a small fund, and it'll be fascinating to see how you deal with the prudential requirements and whether there is actually sufficient liquidity in some of those portfolios to meet this. I think that is one of the key risks here. Now, please don't in any way interpret what I'm saying. I think super funds have been one of the reasons we've actually got through the global financial crisis. The ability to recapitalise our companies and deleverage them is unique to Australia having the capacity of capital which has met every need so far. And therefore, I cannot understand why the government wants to cap superannuation requirements or with the Preservation Act. To me, they are flawed policies and ones that need to be properly addressed. Now, I promise you I'll cover a huge list, but here's my bucket list. What do we need? We need a global regulatory system, but probably with a focus on complementary national legislation and enforcement. Secondly, we need all investment entities to be regulated, supervised, or at least registered. Thirdly, we need differential capital requirements that recognise different leverage and business models. Fourth, we need risk management models which are not compliance-based, but risk appetite-based. We need a solution to the expanding Australian bond market, which does not have the depth, the duration, or the capacity to fund our requirements. We need an improved financial reporting on KPIs, particularly focus on the important thing of cash flow reporting. We also need the means to attract and harness foreign capital to recapitalise our banks and ensure that there is sufficient liquidity in the Australian system going forward. And finally, we need a greater matching of personal liability and asset classes in pensions and retirement funds. If you get all those, I think we will avoid the next global financial crisis in 10 years' time. Thank you.